for school. Well, we can get started. It's just everyone's so calm. It's nice and cool and dark in here. So welcome to this place of respite and art. I'm just going to spend some time today talking a bit about art and theology, because the two are very closely connected for me, and it's fascinating working in both with ideas and theological concepts and art and creativity. And I found it really grounding for me both in my own study of theology and in my own practice of creating art to have this back and forth that's continuously going on. It's very much a dialogue and two different ways of asking questions and expressing ideas, and both have a very spiritual and meditative kind of nature and process to them as well. So we'll share a bit about who I am and the art and theology path that I've been following for the past number of years, and also just get to share a lot of art and images, because that's really fun to see lots of different artistic processes and images. I mean, this will just be kind of a fun, calm, cool art party that afternoon, hopefully. And if at any point you all have questions about a particular piece or something that I'm talking about, I'm very interruptible. So I don't want to just be like speaking at you at this whole time. We can have some conversation and dialogue about both the artistic process and some of the ideas and wonderings, because that makes it a whole lot more fun too. So this space can get sleepy. We can try to keep it interesting. So you probably recognize this image from the cover of Village Voice. Ta-da. Eggs have been a really important part of both the time that I spent here, and this piece in particular was a part of the first series that I did where I was using eggshells to create photographs when I was a student at Luther Seminary. So I might actually, would somebody mind driving the door to see me? Oh yeah, can you see okay? Shall we?
Because the back is back.
It's yeah, there is. Like, was kind of clearing. Yeah. Does that help?
Good.
Cool. Perfect. Yeah, so, and it was during my time at Luther Seminary that a lot of these things really started coming together. But even before that, I did my undergrad at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Woohoo! Got one Oli in the crowd. There are usually a couple at a place like Holden Village. But actually, thinking back to it, I mean, I grew up really immersed in faith community and with theology kind of all around. My dad's a Lutheran pastor, and in my very early years, my first memories of church were actually before he was a pastor, and they involve image, actually. I remember being really, really little and staring at the stained glass windows. There were two in the first church that my family went to. One, both big circular windows, and one that was all blues and cool tones, and the other that was reds and oranges. And so it's interesting that my first memories of church were actually mediated through art, which is kind of a cool thing. And photography, actually, to me, is not unlike stained glass windows. And I learned a little bit more about the theology of stained glass windows when I was still a student. But I think it's really fascinating is this whole concept of illumination and creating sacred space, because Gothic architecture opened up all these possibilities. Churches used to have these really thick walls where no light could come in very easily, and with being able to have advances in architecture opened up these huge spaces for windows, and then you had all this glass and light that suddenly were telling stories and filtering light so that you had this soft glow that created this sense of beauty and sacred space that was a dwelling place of God and the community together. And what was interesting to me about some of the early theological thinking around stained glass windows is that the point of illumination happens when this divine immaterial light meets the lead and glass of the stained glass windows. And so it's this meeting point of light and the physical world where illumination happens and where the story emerges, which I think is just a beautiful image and one that connects really deeply for me making photographs that's all about where light is entering a dark space and creating an image and a story. So that was some early beginnings of my own memory and experience and became a part of doing pinhole cameras. And I was in undergrad and I was learning all about historic process photography and hanging out a ton in the dark room. And it's a very time intensive and repetitive and methodical kind of process too. You have light going through negatives onto paper, and then it's going through these washes and baths. It's very kind of dark waters, wind over waters, Genesis 1 kind of experience, and just the process itself, which I find really fascinating. So this image on the cover of the Village Voice has a pair of the positive. So all of the eggshells were both have a positive and a negative. So this, the white eggshell, you can see here, and when the light comes in, wherever the light hits, kind of burns into the emulsion and creates the dark places. And what is dark actually blocks the light and makes that white shadow. So then, having photographed the eggshell fragment, it gets inverted to the positive. So it's a lot of these back and forth, light and darkness, eggshells breaking, transformation happening. Things are inverted and upended in unexpected ways, in ways that create image and give life, which all has a lot of very spiritual significance.
Do you then use a normal camera to take a picture of the eggshell?
Yes.
In like a dark room or something?
Yeah, I do. So then I photograph them under studio lighting, or sometimes even using some natural light too. So it's both historic process and contemporary process at the same time, which is interesting. So it has these kind of layers of history too, and sort of a photograph of a photograph, if you will. Which is, layers of process. This is taken with just a normal 120 millimeter film, and came from doing a series of work in my time at Luther, where I was thinking a lot about theology as systems of ways of orienting meaning, and how do you go about thinking about God and the world and this person of Jesus and all of these sacred stories. And studying systematic theology, and especially thinking of seeing how much Western thought has influenced Christian theology, I spent a lot of time looking at and seeing how structured and kind of closed in some of the, especially very Western philosophical frameworks are. I mean, it's just that. It's a framework that takes all of these different things and puts them into a very nice and neat and tidy kind of box, which can be a challenge when you have all of these different voices that are stirrings of otherness and what happens to difference and experience and these different times and places that have a lot of unknown and stirring, a difference between theological texts and difference in voices that are often excluded or marginalized by the telling of both history and in our own Christian tradition too. So asking those kind of questions, what are the ways that we create meaning? What are the ways of patterning that? And when do things start to close in and become so structured that differences squash out? And when do things create openings and let light in? How do you loosen some of those very tight holds on what is truth and how do things fit together? And a wanting for certainty and very clear answers that can be difficult to find. So this was some exploring of that through film, through wandering with the camera. And then this was a part of that series too, where I started photographing faces, going off of some Pauline images of face to face and this otherness and opening that comes from difference and being face to face with a neighbor and face to face with the unfolding of God. So yeah, that came out of that thesis work from Luther. And then I kept shooting, actually you'll notice with this, it was a large glass pane that I was using liquid light on top of. So actually the same stuff that I was putting inside the eggshells, I was pouring in a thin layer on glass. So instead of using paper in the dark room to project from the film onto a piece of paper, I was projecting from the film onto glass.
Oh.
Which was really interesting. So this was actually a floating pane of glass standing out from a piece of paper. So I continued, this is a smaller plate, but continued to do these glass plates because the process itself, I think, said something really significant. So unlike framed pieces, these images are actually unbounded and rely on this interplay of light and shadow. You can't actually see the image without seeing through it and seeing light from behind it, too. So very kind of ephemeral and dependent on this back and forth and space between and opening for light. Yeah.
Yeah, just a question. This is very good. An assumption, though, seems to be that we're dealing with the disclosure of meaning, of truth, and that maybe traditionally religious art, you know, whatever that is, pictures of Jesus, Solomon's head of Christ, and all of those, are maybe unable to do this, but would you say that there's no such thing as religious art, or at least that religious subject matter might have nothing to do with religious art as a disclosure of truth?
Yeah, that's a really good question and comment too. It asks,
yeah, the peanut gallery up here thinks so too.
Yeah. Perfect. You guys have a great view from the top stage too. Yeah, I mean it's interesting when you look at especially the role that religious art has played in terms of, you know, I was talking about stained glass windows, which were served a purpose of actually educating people in the church who couldn't read as to the stories and the narratives. And so and you see that tradition in the Eastern Orthodox Church as well. You walk into a church and immediately you see the whole of Scripture and history of the community on all of the walls and ceilings. And I think it's important to note that there are different things happening in art, whether it's depicting something that has like telling a specific story, or doing something that's very representational, or asking a question and maybe not depicting religious imagery as we would normally think about it, but that has a spiritual connection or asks a theological question. That I mean, representation. What is religious art? That's a very good question. What are the labels or boundaries or definitions of that? Which I don't necessarily want to take a firm answer on. I don't know. I think that art that doesn't necessarily have any particularly religious symbolism in it can still ask really profound theological questions and tell stories that relate to biblical narratives. And I think that even representational art can ask questions or show a story in a whole different way. It really, even representational images still, what are you showing and why and how and what questions does it ask? Those pieces are all still there. But they're two very different ways of going about it at the same time. Does that speak into what you're wondering about?
Yeah.
Other people have thoughts, comments?
That's good.
No other thoughts? Okay, I'll keep talking about the art that's on the screen too. It's actually interesting that you bring that up because these, this series of three, well, it was a series of six and I included three here, were all images that I took in different wooded areas of Minnesota. But when I was taking these photos and curating the series, I was thinking about two different biblical narratives. And one is the second creation narrative and the part where Cain rises up against Abel. And it's actually the earth that receives the blood of Abel, and the earth cries out to God. And comes out of thinking about this text and hearing different theologians speak about it as the earth being an actual character in the story that has a voice, is crying out on behalf of this one who was killed unjustly. And hearing that text speak about the role of creation as a story in, or as a character in the story, and as being caught up in humanity's relationship with God and suffering amid the injustice that's being done among the human family. And so thinking about the suffering of our planet today and the fragility and harm and degradation that's being done both with our natural resources and also with vulnerable and marginalized communities that are suffering first and hardest from climate instability, thinking about those realities and photographing the earth as a character in the story, as having presence and making gesture, having movement and lamenting, really, for the injustice that humanity has done and how we've exploited and used creation for our own gain.
So how does this picture do that? Because it just looks like a picture of the ground to me.
Yeah. I mean, when I, it is just a picture of the ground. And it's all about, what you create or see in it. I find that being very attentive to details and seeing these small, intimate landscapes, to me, evokes something more. Maybe it's just a picture of the ground when you look at it through your perspective. When I see this, I actually see fingers and hand reaching across. I see the movement of how the wind was moving that day and gesture and the starkness of just these few branches and how they met and intersected. This is a much more, to me, very peaceful image. That's holding this space of reflection. It's in a wetland in the Chippewa National Forest. And it's grass and plants in a bog. And it, to me, holds light in a very resting, peaceful, hopeful way. But they are not representational exactly of this, of these different narratives. So I was thinking about both that story of the blood-drenched soil with Cain and Abel, And then also the another ancient story about dust and bone in Ezekiel and the Valley of the Dry Bones is coming together, and wind stirring life and speaking a prophetic word of hope into a very desolate and hopeless situation. So holding those two texts together and photographing land with that in mind was what this series came out of. What else do people see when you look at them? Yeah.
With the first one, I saw barbed wire right away, so kind of like moving through adversity, like moving through the different layers of the branches, past the initial ones that are kind of spiked in nature, and trying to see beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, other thoughts, reactions?
But my question, if somebody would, you look at it, you're right, you see the ground and gnarled wood, but then when the explanation comes or the help comes, would that change your perspective? Maybe you could see in that something about the biblical Cain and Abel that is maybe not so apparent, that you sort of have to discover. Or wouldn't it have that possibility?
Yeah, in a way, like, your explanation did help explain. It just...
Yeah, why ground?
Right, and I guess, if I were in a museum looking at this and you weren't there, though, would I get that? And that's what I'm wrestling with, is what significance does this picture have outside of you being there to talk about it?
Yeah, can I add to that? I love that you said that. If I was in a museum,
a little louder.
I was just gonna say that I love that he said that if he was in a museum, she's not gonna be there to talk about it. But in most museums, when you go visit a museum, if you go and visit an artist collection, there is a statement that most artists would write. Whether it's a statement that is right next to the painting, or there's a statement right next to the photo, or whether it is on a brochure or a leaflet, is basically the mission statement of the artist's thoughts and vision for this collection. So most artists would actually have some sort of introduction to the discovery or the journey or their interpretation of what their study is, or the exploration of their study.
Gotcha.
Then it's entirely up to the viewer to have their own interpretation, because how she sees it that she brings to you, the viewers, sometimes can be two very different notions.
Okay.
But it's always, that's why artists always sees it from their point of view, and they're bringing it to the world, that this is how I'm seeing it, I would like to share it with you as a viewer. But most viewers would definitely have their own interpretation and see things very differently.
Okay.
See what you just...
Oh, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, no, and it's like you said everything that I was going to say, which is so delightful. Just to echo that point too, I'll show some pieces actually that were from the residency this winter here that are in a gallery setting. And that's just to take that one step further. So an artist statement is really critical, like Suba was talking about, in terms of what the artist says or discloses or chooses to share about what was going on in their thoughts, in how they were making the images, where the images came from for them, is a pretty standard practice. And sometimes artists choose to not share much at all in an artist statement, and let the images stand alone as just what it is, an image of form or color representation, and that is where it ends, and leaving it intentionally open for the viewer. It's something that I think a lot about, because I don't want an artist statement to have to say, like, here is the fixed meaning of this piece. It can mean here, this is what I say it means. But to share something about, well, here is my meditation on what the soil was saying in this sacred text and what questions it asks of me and my tradition and the crisis of ecology that I'm seeing in the world today. And that meeting point is what's happening for me behind this image. And having it ask questions and not saying too much, but saying enough to guide the perspective of the viewer into the series is a balance that I'm continuously trying to strike in terms of creating an artist statement. So me talking right now is kind of in the place of that. You get the like spontaneous, extemporaneous me talking about where it came from. But then, you know, it's that interplay between what the artist says and brings and then what the viewer brings to that. And one other thing I wanted to say about this too is that I love the Ezekiel text because it's very haunting. You have wind coming in and these bones coming together, and it's this multitude of basically zombies until Ezekiel breathes life into the people again so that they're standing as a living vast multitude. And this sense of hauntingness and stirring up the bounds of what had been dead and closed is something really interesting to me that's stirring in that story. And so to be printing these on small panes of glass that are suspended have a very ghost-like, haunting, stirring sort of quality just in that you don't quite get seeing it on a slide because this is like, you know, 400 times the size. Maybe not quite that. That's extreme. The actual piece is about this big.
And you hang it so that you can see both sides?
Yeah, so it's suspended by like monofilament line from the ceiling.
Oh.
So it's actually out from the wall because if it's too close, it's just shadow as light goes right through it. So it's standing out and then usually against hanging paper behind it. And there's usually a little bit of motion, and you can see some of the shadow on the paper from the light coming through. So there's the first image, and then there's like dispersed shadow behind it too. And so you see the space in between, and you see it floating. And you can see even on the edges here from the pore of the emulsion that there's variation. That little white dot isn't there on the film. It's there in the pore of the emulsion. And you get cracking around the edges and these different things that I find do slightly veil or obscure the image in ways that are very, they add some intrigue and some haunting kind of quality to it, which I find really interesting. You can see it on the bottom here too, just kind of cracking. It has a very material and organic kind of feel to it. So all of those kinds of things about the process and the experience of even seeing it in the space add to it also. And then there are the quail eggs. That this is from just above the ball field. Here holding, you can see Martin Ridge, the edge of it in the back. In the back there, and this one is titled Of Snow and Ash. And so making this whole series of work at Holden right after the Wolverine Creek fire and this fresh bed of snow coming at the end of February and photographing through March and the first week of April was long enough after the fire that it wasn't like this immediate still burning kind of thing. But it was this sort of peaceful calm immediately after this huge event that left a big trace of ash on the valley, which I actually found really fascinating to think about in relationship with photography because we use the term burning often to talk about how darkroom processes happen. And it's actually halide crystals changing their structure based on how photons hit them. But it's sort of like this burning process where the light hits and it leaves a trace. That's this dark, kind of ashy looking remnant. So to be making photographs of an ashen valley to me held very special significance too, and to be held in an egg, a place of liminality and transition and breaking open, which can be a traumatic kind of event of breaking, but also one that creates space for new life and birth. So this is actually a great view of the valley held in an eggshell. And these quail eggs are very, very tiny, by the way. So it's also, it's funny for me every time seeing them this big on the projector, because they're such small, intimate pieces. And this is the negative, or the positive of it too. So that's buckskin, and it probably looks a little different because they're actually mirrored in the process of the film too. So yeah, I'll just kind of chat some more about it as we flip through, because I want, this is kind of a chance to show, I made a ton of images while I was here, but to show a lot of what came out of that time. So this was a very large tree that, sort of hard to tell, but it was one of the really big ones, and it just burned all the way up. And I learned, I titled this Burned Mother Tree, because I learned about how some of the earliest trees in a particular area are very pivotal in seeding the rest of the trees. And when you see one that's bigger than any of the trees around it and clearly been around longer, sometimes that'll be termed the mother tree. So it was interesting walking and seeing this tree that had seeded the rest but had burned in the fire, and the other ones living in that one having come down in that process. So this seeds and flow of life and loss is a part of that image. This one is black cottonwoods that are right down behind Narnia. And this one I took actually on the last day that I was in the village. It was my motivation to pack, because I would go out and shoot one more time. and it's burned alder in the snow, also up near the ball field area. And I didn't develop it until I got back to the Twin Cities. And to be making these images, I had to wrap the entire quail egg in electrical tape to keep light from getting, you have to make it a light tight chamber for it to work as a camera obscura. So it's always this like very kind of, you know, no pressure moment of unwrapping these very fragile eggshells from electrical tape before developing them. And this one had been sitting in the tape for a long time. It compromised the structure of the eggshell, and it got this big crack in it when I, in the process of unwrapping and developing it. But I loved how the crack comes right down and almost mirrors this alder branch. And so working in a process where, you know, you don't have a viewfinder, you just point the eggshell and you don't know what it's gonna look like exactly until after you've developed it in the darkroom. So this sort of uncertainty and making space for the unexpected that happens, and the way things crack and what happens to come in, is another spiritual invitation to the stirring of the spirit in the world.
Why did you pick eggshells?
I was just going to ask, did you make this up? Or had,
oh, yeah.
Had somebody did it before?
Yes. Two great questions. How did I come up with it, and why eggshells? So similar. Why pinhole cameras is because the process of making images, like I've been talking about, has a lot of significance, and process really fuels the creativity of the work for me in a lot of ways. And so thinking about new ways to expand or push open the process and push the bounds of what makes a photograph and what image or what materials are used, because material is such an important part of it. For me, is those are the questions that drive the process. And so I was looking through a photo book of a photographer named Abelarda Morel, who's like this famous, renowned sort of father of pinhole photography. And I saw a reference to an egg form, and it was kind of unclear. It was like this very small photo in the part of a page. Wait, did he use eggs? Did he make a pinhole camera? It's kind of unclear, and there's only part of an image, but I thought he might have tried that, and I bet it would work, and I'm gonna see what happens and find some liquid light and run with it. And so it became sort of this experiment, and I was really captivated by it, this holding of an image in an eggshell and what that material feels like and the symbolic significance of it. And it was a fun challenge and came out with these like very intriguing, beautiful organic images held in this fragile organic form. And I ran with it and had done chicken eggs first, and then being here, I wanted to try something different for this creative time and space that I set aside. And so I was like, well, I could go smaller, I could go big, I'm gonna go with quail eggs. And I showed up off the bus with a suitcase of 8 dozen quail eggs that I promptly procured in Chalet 2, much to the amusement of Laura and Fredheim and Will Childs, the other two resident artists, who looked at me like, what are you gonna be doing? And Will's a musician, and Laura is a writer and does performance and theater. So they both, like, wow, your work is very material. Especially when I was like cleaning out an ostrich egg and had handfuls of membrane on porcelain. So, yeah, material. It's important and interesting. So, yeah, this is from a tree that I found out in Winston area, and I love how the branches curve down into the snow. And it's one that you might not even know that's what it is. But it actually is part of this tree, which was, speaking of, ostrich egg pinhole camera. So that's why it looks so much clearer. And when I printed it for the gallery exhibition, it was actually about that size. On the wall of the gallery. So this was the one that was large scale among all the very small, intimate quail egg pieces. So that's the gallery. So you can see them on the back wall there. And this is that's the actual ostrich egg in the nest form. If you can see the image of it on the back. So I wanted to show these just because I know most of you actually weren't here when I was here in March, but a couple were, and I showed some images there, but I kept talking about it'll be on walls in the gallery, it's going to be have a whole different life and shape after it leaves the village. So this is what that looks like. And I love how they're all in pairs, so you're kind of constantly going in this back and forth and seeing these glimpses of snow-covered ashen landscape. And so there are a lot of images, so it was nice that they were small because I was able to share just a ton of the photos that I made and came away with. And these on the pedestals are actually nests that held a couple of the original quail egg cameras. And they kind of went around the corner, these little pictures. And I showed with another friend of mine and fellow artist named Sheila Novak, who actually did the Holden Art Residency for Ecology Spirituality Committee 2 years prior to me. So I think it was 2014 that she was here. But she also uses eggshells as material and inspiration in her work, and so it was really a nice kind of side-by-side pairing. So Over here you can see her sculpture. That's an emu egg that has been broken open and has like, it's been blackened on the inside as well and suspended between the wood blocks. And I showed some of the eggs set into pieces of wood, in driftwood particularly. So this is a small eggshell on a piece of driftwood. And these were small ceramic egg forms that I made here as well. George Lowe, the village potter here, taught me how to mix a very clear, almost porcelain-like, translucent clay body that I made small egg forms out of that show something about how light is carried and how vessels of space. A couple more driftwood pieces. That's the alder remnant one that's nested in there. And this one I thought was just so fortunate how the wood curved, and so what I was doing to set these pieces was very gently carve in the form of the egg so it would sit right nested in there. And that was some collaborative work between me and Sheila, the other artist too. So this piece is the one that I brought back framed to have a life of its own here in the village. So the two right down there on the table are this one. Yeah, this is also taken down near the ball field area and sort of akin to what I was talking about with the Ezekiel text and the stirring. I entitled this one Ghosts, because of just how ephemeral and soft the image is. It has this very beautiful, quiet, but also sort of stirring, haunting quality about it. And it's right across from Honeymoon Heights and right by Winston. And so I felt like a lot of this time I was treading on this land that was so historied and storied, that there's such a presence of people and community and ways that this land has changed and also invited a lot of comings and goings and lives and stories of people that have treaded the same space. So the title of that this piece was a reflection of that. But I've been talking for a while, so let's talk about this piece since it's one that's staying. What do other people see in it, or what do some of the things that I've been talking about with this work stick out to you or make you wonder about?
The way this egg is with the dark edge around it, it made the opening really jump out for me, and I just thought of the word portal. It looks like a portal. And so I just had all these images, like this tiny egg, this big world, you know, almost like, you know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe sort of step through. But sometimes you step through these portals and you don't know the world you're going to discover. You don't know the images, you don't know the ghosts that are there, you don't know what you're going to discover. And I don't know why that particularly this image, I just thought it was saying, step in.
They almost hold these tiny spaces of light and landscape that, you feel almost like you can go right.
But knowing it's, like you said, it's so tiny.
Yeah.
It's only that big.
Yeah.
It's a ways back, but I really liked hearing what you had to say about the mother tree image, especially the first one. Because in the first one, you're almost given the illusion that that mother tree has its branches coming down like a willow, because all the other lines like seem to be coming from its base. So you're given, you're given that illusion, which like isn't the case. But in that illusion, you're being connected to a biological truth in that the seeds are falling, and like those other trees are coming from that base tree.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Cool. I like the symbolic meaning of all of this being in an egg. It just almost feels like, and you might have touched that because it was in the egg, but But I like the idea that there's life inside that egg. It's almost like there's birth and there's life inside. But it's such a nice contrast of the images that you have taken was after the fire, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just that sense of hope, I really like that. I like that there's life growing inside this vessel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that transition and birth and life and mm-hmm. death held together in these images is definitely something I thought a lot about. And one thing that people have mentioned to me too, in looking at the images, is with how organic the shapes are, they do have this sort of life formness to them. You know, like the branches almost look like they could be veins, or seeing different kinds of human or animal life reflected in the way that the branches come together is an interesting, for me and others, has prompted reflection on interconnectedness too of organic forms of life.
Is that shell actually spottled, or is it?
Yep.
It's not, I mean, it wasn't something in the developing, it actually was a spotted.
No, yeah, it's actually spotted on the egg itself. And quail eggs are really unique. They have, the spots look different on different eggs. Some actually look almost more marbled. Mm-hmm. And some have really dark, like polka dot type spots. Others are more like speckled. And with quail eggs, it was a way of, you know, they were another type of egg that I could have readily accessible because, as you can imagine, lots break or don't expose right. There's a lot of trial and error. So you need a lot of eggs to be able to work consistently. And quail eggs were a way of finding a different type of egg, but ones that reminded me a little bit more of songbirds than of kitchen. So that's why I was.
Where could you get quail eggs?
From the co-op is where I got them. They came from Owatonna, Minnesota,
huh.
The farm down there. But yeah, you can buy them by the dozen and a half at Mississippi Market in St. Paul. So yeah, it was easy enough to do.
You know, what makes this so fascinating is not so much that everybody can look at that and then discern their own particular meaning, but precisely the opposite, that as these last comments have really indicated, that when you are drawn into this, you discover these universals. Not the particulars. I mean, in the particular, you get this universal, because we're talking about life. We're talking about death. We're talking about brokenness. We're talking about estrangement, healing, growth, new life. I mean, these are universals. And at least to me, this is so fascinating that people can have their own particular vision. But you're getting a vision of something that you know deep down in your gut has to do with the essential things of death and life.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very particular images and reflections on really big concepts that mm-hmm. everybody can relate to. I actually realized I was going to do this and didn't get it started until just now, but I was going to pass these around too, so you can see them up close. I might turn. But it's nice to see them big up here, but it's also really great to be able to actually hold the print and the frame.
Is the print actual size, or is it enlarged?
It's also enlarged, yeah. Quail eggs themselves are about that big. So very incredibly small. So it's actually really interesting when I came back from being here and I basically had all of these small Tupperware filled with quail eggs because they're very fragile. So I had my like favorite kind of super durable Tupperware that like I could throw it across the room and the quail egg would be fine, which is amazing. So I had all of these like, I didn't actually try that. It was too scary.
Yeah.
But they're very, very hard Tupperware and very padded in there. So they're safe, but bringing them home, I had seen, you know, I'd spent a lot of time looking at them very closely, but photographing them and enlarging them, it opened up these very small images in ways that were remarkable. And then when I went back and hold the eggshells now, I hold them differently, and I hold them with more reverence, and I see more in them than I saw the first time because of how they became bigger, and then that bigness was translated back into the smallness. So that was interesting, just in my own experience of how the art took shape.
And that's kind of how I see it too. What I respond to is like this, this small intimacy, and you look in, and it's like a big event in there. Usually, right? That it's a massive tree, or like the entire. This massive tree is contained in a tiny seed. It's already in there. It's just a matter of time that it grows. Mm-hmm. So I'm drawn into that intimacy to think bigger. Mm-hmm. And I think I also compliment you on the way you hung the show, because I think a lot of those images, the way they're spaced in the gallery, drew you into that intimacy too.
Yeah.
You know, into a corner, into a space that reflects the work itself. So.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely. And in their pairs, so they're all in pairs and then in a series of six, which is actually three images with their inverse. And so they all had these different little patterns and little narratives to them. And I, they've retained that as I've shown them here. So you can see, you know, there's a while where you're in cracked branches and snow, and then you're in these big, more thoughtful, wider landscapes. This one I just thought was so interesting, these three trees grouped together. And for whatever reason, felt drawn to name it Three Sisters, because they seem to be this little sort of huddle of trees that had a relationship there. And then it's harder to, I won't turn the light down after I'm still looking, but there's one small burned tree down here in the lower corner. And so there's different kinds of trees along this ridge. And this was Martin Ridge, right? It's kind of behind Chalet Hill that was very dramatically affected by the fire, too. This is Buckskin Peak that I took from Copper Basin, actually. I really enjoyed how kind of goofy of a process it was, too. I had usually like about six prepped quail eggs that I had spent the day before preparing, wrapped in electrical tape with the pinholes and flaps and everything, in my little Tupperware, in my fanny pack. I hiked up the mountain, and so I'd get there and I'd put down my tripod and whip out my egg cameras from the fanny pack and take a photo like miles out from the village, which is really fun, and you don't know until you get back, you know, how it turned out. But this, I love that just hiking up close, I was able to get so close to Buckskin Peak, because this was from the first avalanche shoot. It was actually, there was low avalanche danger that day, and we went, this is as far in as I went, just past the first shoot in Copper
Basin. How long is the exposure time on those?
Oh yeah, it all really depends. This one, because there is so much sky and snow, it's a lot of light reflecting off and coming in, and it's open space, so it's probably a very quick exposure. I would take very thorough notes on from my light meter readings, and they were anywhere from my guess of half a second to I think the longest one was maybe a solid couple minutes. But yeah, so a very wide range of exposure times.
So now we're dealing like eggs and taking pictures. What's your success rate like? kind of like your feel for how it works and how it goes for it?
I got a lot better at it in the 6 weeks that I was here. I think of the 8 dozen quail eggs I brought, I think I shot about 6 dozen, and I think I ended up with like 35 or so workable images. And I exhibited, I think, 35 pieces, which is, or 36 pieces. Which is actually half of that in terms of eggshells. So that gives you kind of a sense. So I had plenty that were workable, and then I was curating, like tearing down from that. And then actually had even, I had 6 more that I brought to the gallery that I didn't show because there wasn't space, which is the best problem to have, to be curating a show and have more than enough art than there is space than you. Forces you to be very selective. This one I took on the hike up to Big Creek, and I love because it's the pattern of light on the snow. And pinhole cameras, you get a really wide angle, so you can see all the way down. Oh, actually, since the photos are around, turn off the lights again. But you can see all the way down the hill in both directions, because we're kind of up on this little path. So I was hiking, and the path actually went right through those couple of trees there, and so it's like, I was going with a couple of other folks. Like, stop, wait, don't walk there yet, let me take a picture first. And they waited for me as I set up my camera and went. And then this one I titled Sunrise Along the Fire Road. And Suba, actually, it was really crazy this morning walking out to do the 10-mile hike. We walked that small part of the fire road before going out there, and we were going at, like, right at sunrise as the sun was coming through. And this was taken, so if you see those couple bright spots, or sorry, couple black dots there, that's actually the sun coming through the trees. And I happened upon that exact spot on the fire road this morning at sunrise, with the sun coming right through the trees in pretty much the same place as that photo was taken. And this one is so clear too. It feels like you can walk right into it. And it's one that I've really cherished since my time here. And so it was a really special moment this morning in meditation to walk into that same scene many months later in a different time and season for the landscape. And this one was one that I didn't even realize would work until I was photographing it later, but it's fog over part of the mountain with a few snags of trees that died from bog, actually, from the river moving a little bit over time than from fire. And some spruce needles, just for fun at the end. So. Are there any other final questions or comments or thoughts as we wrap up?
We do have a question. How many did you take that worked, and how many that didn't?
That's pages.
Oh yeah, I'd have to calculate it out, but it was about 6 dozen that I took, and about 40 that worked.
Wow.
So actually pretty decent. Like, there's a handful that didn't work, but for the most part, they were workable, at least. Some of them were like, oh, it worked, it's good exposure, but it's kind of boring. Yeah, I'm going to nix that one. So it was that kind of combination of what worked and then what really stuck as compelling images. So, yeah.
Could you say one word about art and the church? I remember someone who said, the quickest way to become an atheist is to walk through a religious supply shop. And I sort of agree with that.
Religious supply shop.
Because there you see the surface. That's it. That is this picture. It's like so much art you see hanging in churches that does not really allow this ability to participate.
Yeah.
In it, discern it. hear it with a word, with the word, to help you understand, so that you have to really enter into that, like we've had to do with these tremendous images. But I mean, I for one cringe when I go into many churches and see
things. Yeah, you know, those comments just remind me of a phrase that really stuck with me from an artist and also in the Twin Cities who was a significant voice for me at a pivotal time when I was exploring all this art and theology stuff. And she told me, she's like, you know, I think a lot of artists have felt uncomfortable in the church because artists the church has so often been a place of giving answers, and artists are so often creating art that asks questions. And so I think that tension is very real, and I think sometimes there is an absence of art that asks questions or creates space or openness for that engagement. It's also some of the assumptions that we bring to art when we look at it, that this is supposed to tell us something instead of bringing our own questions to it. So I think it's kind of both and there. I don't want to flame all artists everywhere for telling people what to think in the church. But I think that it points to an issue, too, of what kind of art are we making, and is there space for art and creativity? Is there space for questions and exploration that is beyond what we normally think of when we think about religious art or art and theology? And creating space for that is so important and has certainly made me find my own place in religious community in ways that I would not have before. So.
Thank you.
Probably a good note to end on. I don't want to keep you here. The dark. Oh, and one other.